Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the November 24th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. One of the most unfortunate and discouraging phenomena of our times has been the unwillingness of our leading alternative media to allow any discussion or reporting that questions the Bush administration narrative of what happened at the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. That the mainstream media would keep the lid on any such discussion might be predictable, but that the alternative media has been no better is remarkable considering that polls have shown that more than 40% of the public question the official story and believe the Bush administration was complicit. I have covered the 9/11 attack several times in the past, the most recently with David Ray Griffin a year ago last September. Ray Griffin, who had written a book on the subject, spoke about the collapse of the 47-story Building 7 at the World Trade Center not long after the collapse of the towers, which has never been satisfactorily explained since it was hit by no airplane or any part of an airplane. Listening to an interview with David Ray Griffin in 2006 with San Francisco architect Richard Gage, who became interested in researching the destruction of the World Trade Center high-rises himself after hearing David Ray Griffin's startling conclusions and embarked upon his own determined quest for the truth about 9/11. That led him to found Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. As of yesterday, 1,372 verified architectural and engineering professionals had signed the organization's petition demanding that Congress conduct a truly independent investigation of what actually caused the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center and Building 7 to collapse. At approximately 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Richard Gage, and I'll be opening the phones for your questions in the latter part of the program. Meanwhile, let's look at some other stories, beginning with the sad news that Chalmers Johnson, a former government intelligence analyst who had become one of the most important critics of U.S. foreign policy and was twice a guest on Takes on the World, died Saturday from complications of long-term rheumatoid arthritis at his home in Cardiff by the sea in Southern California. I had hoped to interview Johnson regarding the fourth and last book that he had written, concluding a series on the American Empire. It was entitled, appropriately, Dismantling the Empire, America's Last Best Hope, which had recently been published by Metropolitan Books. Chalmers Johnson was 79. Now to some other news. Not since the first President Bush went on national television to tell the American people why he was opposing the granting of $10 billion in loan guarantees to Israel on the morning of September 12, 1991, has there been such an apparent crisis in Israel-U.S. relations. By now, most of you have probably heard or read about what has been widely described as a bribe, namely the outrageous offers the Obama administration has made to get Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to agree to a 90-day extension of the solid settlement freeze, one that reportedly would not include Jewish settlements in East Jerusalem. What the administration was said to be offering Israel just for this three-month building freeze was an additional 150 million a pop F-35 fighters absolutely free, on top of the 150 million dollars a pop F-35 fighters that the administration already signed off on, plus the agreement that Israel could continue to control the Jordan Valley deep in the West Bank for at least a year after Palestinian state came into being, if it ever came into being, and a guarantee that the U.S. would continue to veto any UN resolution at the Security Council that Israel opposed. Moreover, should Israel agree to the settlement freeze, and there is no peace agreement at the end of 90 days, Obama promised not to request any further extension of the freeze. The first reports a week ago Sunday said that Netanyahu had agreed to the trade-off, but that will be subject to the approval of his cabinet, every member which is opposed to withdrawing from the settlements and allowing the establishment of a Palestinian state of any size. One might think that was a fairly generous offer, but the members of his cabinet, feeling themselves even more in the driver's seat of U.S. Middle East policy since the recent U.S. elections weren't rushing to accept it. As described by Haaretz, Israeli Vice Premier Moshe Yaalon lashed out at the new American proposal during a stormy meeting of ministers from Netanyahu's Likud party. "Extending the freeze is a honey trap," Yaalon said, "which will lead us down a slippery slope and into another crisis with the American administration after 3 months or perhaps even sooner." Another vice premier, there are several of them, was quoted as saying, quote, "It is a strategic error to condition an American veto and diplomatic support from Washington upon the continuation of a building freeze. It is something that should go without saying, based on the special relationship between our countries," end quote. Cabinet members from the powerful Shas party, which represents the Middle Eastern and North African Jews, they call them Mizrahim, said they would not oppose the deal if it did not restrict Jewish building in East Jerusalem. That was a concern of all the cabinet members who demanded to see Washington's promises in writing to make sure that the building freeze does not include Jewish building in Palestine and East Jerusalem. "And while you're at it," added Netanyahu, "we want you to release the American Jewish spy, Jonathan Pollard, who has been granted Israeli citizenship while in prison." 39 members of the U.S. Congress, 10 of them members of the Congressional Black Caucus, have sent Obama a letter asking him to grant clemency in Pollard's case, a decision which has long been opposed by the intelligence community, which is not subject to the pro-Israel lobby's whims and is not likely to occur. The offer was apparently made to Netanyahu, the total offer, by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in a 7.5-hour meeting she had with the Israeli Prime Minister when he was in the U.S. 2 weeks ago to speak at a meeting of the Jewish Federations of North America in New Orleans. And there are now questions being raised as to whether her offerings to Netanyahu had been cleared in advance with Obama, who was traveling in Asia. Getting the White House to issue a, quote, clear written document that excluded Jewish neighborhoods of East Jerusalem from any settlement freeze would represent a policy precedent on Jewish neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, former Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer told the Jerusalem Post last Thursday. It would represent the first time that Washington had clearly stated its policy with respect to East Jerusalem, Kurtzer said, and therefore indicated it was highly unlikely that a clear written commitment would be made. An American official denied one of the alleged comments, also on commitments on Thursday, telling Haaretz that a construction ban would include East Jerusalem. Quote, he said, "If the moratorium deal goes through, we will continue to press for quiet throughout East Jerusalem during the 90 days, regardless of what Netanyahu is telling Shas now," the official said. Yesterday, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, citing U.S. officials, reported that Washington has a letter prepared for Israel guaranteeing security enhancements, but will not add the Jerusalem pledge on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's wish list. A letter sending out incentives for Israel to extend a partial freeze on settlement building was ready to go to Israel over last weekend, but was held up, reportedly, because of Netanyahu's new demands on Jerusalem. However it ends up, Obama has suffered another stinging humiliation at Israel's hands. As a British journalist, Robert Fisk, put it in an article in The Independent, quote, "In the ordinary, sane world in which we think we live, there's only one word for Barack Obama's offer, appeasement. Usually our lords and masters use that word with disdain and disgust." I can imagine what Fisk would have said had he read a report in Defense News that the U.S. media skipped, that the Obama administration plans to move an additional $400 million worth of military equipment to emergency storage in Israel over the next 2 years. The equipment, which includes so-called smart bombs, is for Israel's disposal in an emergency, or what it claims is an emergency, such as 2006 war in Lebanon, which it made use of the stockpile. U.S. Congress, always at the ready to show its loyalty to Israel, approved the hike last month, which will bring the value of American military equipment stockpiled there to $1.2 billion by 2012. The U.S. stores equipment in Israel by virtue of a special clause in U.S. foreign aid law governing war reserve stockpiles for allies. According to the clause, the equipment can be utilized by American forces throughout the world and also in an emergency by the military in the country where the stockpile is stored. There was no record that the U.S. has ever used any of the stockpile in Israel. In other words, it's a gift to our faithful ally from our American taxpayers. Before we leave Congress, you may not have heard or read the words of Representative Eric Cantor, who before the election was a lone Jewish Republican in Congress, and he was slated to become the House Majority Leader in the next Congress. Cantor made a point of meeting with Netanyahu while he was in New York with Israeli Ambassador to the U.S. Michael Oren and Netanyahu's National Security Advisor Uzi Arad also in attendance. After the meeting, the Virginia Congressman's office issued this statement, quote, Eric stressed that the new Republican majority will serve as a check on the administration and what has been up until this point one-party rule in Washington. He made clear that the Republican majority understands a special relationship between Israel and the United States and that the security of each nation is reliant upon the other, end quote. Questions were raised about what Cantor was doing meeting one-on-one with the Israeli prime minister and of his apparent pledge of loyalty to Israel against his own president. His office said that was a wrong interpretation to give to the statement and that, quote, Eric has a long-standing friendship with Prime Minister Netanyahu and appreciated the opportunity to catch up last evening, end quote. To give you a sense of the passionate attachment of this country to the state of Israel, what our first president, George Washington, warned Americans against in his farewell address. Let's conclude this morning's segment with a selection of the speech made by Vice President Joe Biden at the meeting of the Jewish Federations of North America, where he shared the spotlight with Netanyahu. Here is Joe Biden.
I told an audience at Tel Aviv University just the 2 days later that this administration represents an unbroken chain of American leaders who have understood this critical strategic relationship, one in which we will not yield one single inch. And let me restate what probably does not need to be restated, but I've known many of you in this audience for a long, long time. President Barack Obama feels exactly the same way I do. I assure you. Look, folks, the ties between our countries are literally, literally unbreakable. Our common values are interwoven in our cultures and our mutual interests, none more urgent than the shared struggle against the scourge of violent extremism and terrorists. That's why the President has moved so forcefully and with such determination against the repeated attempts to delegitimize Israel. There's a worldwide campaign going on in some quarters to delegitimize Israel. We've seen it before, and we continue to see it. Attempts to single out Israel for criticism or to deny it the right to self-defense like all other nations have. The President has reinforced this for all the world to hear in his Cairo speech and to the representatives of all countries of the United Nations when he said, after 60 years in the community of nations, Israel's existence must not be subject to debate. The President went on to tell the Assembly that Israel is a sovereign state and the historic homeland of the Jewish people. It should be clear to all, it should be clear to all that efforts to chip away at Israel's legitimacy will only be met by unshakable opposition by the United States of America. End of quote. And these were not just words. This president has put those words into action. That's why we withdrew from the Durban Review Conference in February of last year due to anti-Israeli violence. That's why, in the wake of the Goldstone Report, we loudly and repeatedly claimed our support for Israel's right to defend itself and the ability of its domestic institutions to conduct their own investigations. That's why We have consistently opposed anti-Israeli resolutions in the UN Human Rights Council and the General Assembly and UNESCO. Indeed, at the President's instruction, we were the only no vote on two Human Rights Council resolutions in September. One, the flotilla incident, and one, the follow-up to the Goldstone report. That's why, at the direction of President Obama, as Bibi will tell you and the ambassador will tell you, I spent hour after hour in the aftermath of the flotilla incident trying to put it in its proper focus and ensure that Israel had its right to conduct its own independent investigation. And that's why the President has continued to fight to ensure that Israel is included in all international bodies to which it should rightfully belong, including regional groupings at the United Nations and the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which, with our help and strong support, Israel joined for the first time this year. It's also why the Jewish Federation's recent initiative to counter delegitimization attempts through Israel Action Network is so important and so appreciated by the President and me. And it is why, as I will say more about in a moment, we think it's critical to keep the international spotlight on the genuine threats in the region, like Iran's nuclear program, not Israel.
And that was Joe Biden, Vice President Joe Biden, one heartbeat away from the presidency. Now, my guest today, Richard Gage, AIA, is a San Francisco Bay Area architect and a member of the American Institute of Architects. He is a founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, better known by its acronym AE9/11 Truth. He has been a practicing architect for over 20 years and has worked on most types of building construction, including numerous fireproof steel frame buildings. Most recently, he worked on the construction documents for a $400 million mixed-use urban project with 1.2 million square feet of retail parking structure and 320,000 square feet of mid-rise office space, altogether about with 1,200 tons of steel framing. I decided to interview Richard Gage when I read online of a press conference that he and the architects and engineers from 9/11 Truth had given at the National Press Club this past September 10th, in which not a word was published in the mainstream press, at least that I saw, nor, sorry to say, was a report on the Democracy Now!, which apparently has decided to imitate the mainstream media in suppressing the story. So welcome, Richard Gage, to Takes on the World.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's my honor to be here with you.
At that press conference in Washington on September 10th, you mentioned that the science advisors of every member of Congress were given a DVD outlining the forensic evidence of the World Trade Center buildings attack that were taken down by explosive controlled demolition, which you're going to tell us about today, that you met with over a dozen of the science advisors of the congressmen and presented your evidence in detail, that over 400 of them were personally invited and yet not a one showed up. Were you surprised, and what does that tell you?
Well, it's indicative of the reality that this issue does not want to be handled. People, A, don't want to look backwards, B, don't want to be in pain about the possible implications, C, would much rather pass this off as some sort of a conspiracy theory. What are we talking about? We're talking about the destruction of three high-rises on 9/11, and we're talking about the opinions, the professional opinions of 1,370 architects and engineers who have signed our petition at ae911truth.org, demanding a new investigation of these three high-rises. Most people are only aware of the destruction of the Twin Towers on 9/11. There was a third high-rise that collapsed on 9/11. It's the third worst structural failure in modern history, and yet most architects and engineers are completely unaware of it. So So I want to present the evidence today for that that building, which is more obviously an explosive-controlled demolition. May I tell you about that building first before we talk about the political implications of this?
Oh, you certainly may, because obviously the Building 7 and how it came down is directly related, obviously, to the World Trade Center, or appeared to be, and how the World Trade Center towers came down. So please do so.
Yeah, this was a 47-story skyscraper that was on the grounds of World Trade Center complex, and it was not hit by an airplane. It's about 350 feet from the North Tower. And the North Tower and South Tower go down the morning of 9/11, and there was some debris that hit this other skyscraper, started some fires. Those fires burned 4 or 5 hours. And then in the afternoon, with just a few scattered fires here and there, about 8 of them in this building, it begins suddenly at 5:20 in the afternoon to fall straight down almost into its footprint almost at free fall acceleration for half of its 6.5-second collapse. It is falling as fast as a bowling ball dropping off the side of it. It's smooth, symmetrical, sudden, straight down. Now, we have videos of this, about 8 of them, and they are directly comparable and look exactly like an explosive-controlled demolition, like the old hotels in Las Vegas that we've seen coming down on videos. When people, architects, engineers, and others see this building coming down, they automatically register in their minds that this is a controlled demolition. So everybody gets that because a building can't go straight down through the path of greatest resistance, 40,000 tons of structural steel in this building. Without that steel being removed floor by floor, synchronistically timed, and all at once on a given floor within a fraction of a second of each other, those columns have to be removed. Any deviation from that pattern and the building will begin to tip over. So people register immediately that this is an explosive demolition, but the official story, NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, was tasked with, explains that this is due to normal office fires. And this is a complete non sequitur for those of us looking at the building. We know this is fire is an organic process. It moves through the building every 20 minutes or so, you know, leaving one area burned out and looking for fresh new fuel sources. So when any kind of a building collapses due to fire, it's an organic, chaotic, messy process, but never before in history has there been a high-rise office fire that's collapsed due to fire. Fires just don't bring these massive buildings down. They're fireproofed, first of all, and these massive steel structures conduct the heat away from the source throughout the massive heat sink that is the structural steel frame in these buildings. So none of the official story doesn't make sense from beginning to end relative to the hypothetical collapse theory, how it starts and so forth. So not only that, at the base of this building, in the debris pile, we have several tons of molten metal. This turns out to be molten iron, although the first responders are calling it molten steel, flowing like lava, they say. I mean, there's the huge meteorites, they call them, of the cooled, fused, molten metal being pulled up from these piles. The first responders, firefighters, fire protection engineers have never seen this kind of melted steel or molten iron, as it turns out to be. In a debris pile of a fire, because fire isn't hot enough to melt steel. deal. It's only about 1,500 degrees, about half the temperature required to melt steel. Well, where do these temperatures come from to create all this molten iron or melted steel? The molten metal has been analyzed chemically. It has the evidence in it of thermite, an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. So we have the evidence in the debris pile for the demolition of the structural system in this building by incendiaries. This is extraordinary. This is actually even documented by FEMA, who did the first real investigation into this report. Their report in this building, their report came out in May of 2002. What does it document? The melting of steel, first of all. So they're documenting temperatures that can't possibly happen in a fire, a normal office fire. They're documenting sulfidation of steel, which is sulfur is added to thermite and becomes thermate. It lowers the melting point of the steel. And rapid oxidation of the ends of these beams and even evaporation of the ends of these beams. So this is extraordinary proof. Now, NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, comes in. They take over this investigation after that report. They throw out the report. It doesn't appear in the investigation today. This is critical evidence. Not only that, all the steel from this third worst structural failure in modern history has been, by the time the report came out from FEMA, and that report hypothesized that they have no idea how this building was destroyed, because their best hypothesis, which is fire, has a very low probability of occurrence, they say. And yet all the steel had been taken to China for recycling. And so they say, well, what happened to this building? I don't know. Let's look at the steel. Well, it was destroyed, save one piece. And this is the one piece that was documented by FEMA in their Appendix C with all of this damage that fires, that I just described, that fires cannot possibly do.
My guest is architect Richard Gage of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and we're talking now about the collapse, mysterious collapse of Building 7 at World Trade Center. Please continue.
Well, as if this isn't damning enough evidence, because it pulls the rug out from under the official story completely as to how Building 7 came down. Throughout all of the dust in the World Trade Center, and this, there's more damning evidence, a whole lot more. This dust is 4 to 12 inches thick, completely covering lower Manhattan and across the river to New Jersey. Pulverized concrete, we're talking about particles that are like talcum powder. So 90,000 tons of concrete inside the World Trade Center towers, which make up the floors, is completely pulverized, laying like a blanket of snow, thick snow. In this, in addition to the pulverized concrete, the USGS, U.S. Geological Survey, finds billions of very small, previously molten iron microspheres. These are spheres the size of the diameter of a human hair. They have no rational reason how these could have been in all the World Trade Center dust. It's simply not explained in the reports. They're just cited as being there. Every sample has up to 6% of the weight of the sample is these spheres. It's so abundant that they characterize it as it's not even World Trade Center dust unless it has these spheres. Well, being molten iron is in itself evidence that temperatures exceeded 2,700 degrees, 3,000 degrees, or more. Being spherical is evidence that molten iron was under explosive conditions, atomized. When a liquid is atomized, it forms itself into spheres. So what we're going to, so this is evidence that some aluminothermic event, thermite, has taken place at massive scale, because there's several tons of these spheres found in, altogether in the dust. Well, how would they have formed? If there were thousands of thermite cutter charges, which thermite being an incendiary that releases several tons, if there's that much, of molten iron as a byproduct. And so under explosive conditions, it would, by its surface tension, form itself into spheres as it's being atomized. So this is direct evidence of incendiaries as well in the Twin Towers. Now, that's backed up by what they also find in the dust, these curious small red-gray chips found by this team of international scientists. And all the samples have these. The largest one is the 16th of an inch. They're red on one side, gray on the other. The red side is composed of extremely small particles of what? Of unignited thermite, basically. But the iron oxide and aluminum powders are at the nanoscale. They're engineered. They're a thousand times smaller than the human hair. They are in the perfect proportion to each other, these two different particles, as to become thermite, 25% iron oxide, 75% iron oxide, 25% aluminum. And they're intimately mixed and set in an organic bed of silica, oxygen, and carbon. This is extremely sophisticated, engineered, nanothermite composite explosive. Explosive because of the extremely small size of these and them being set in this carbon content. This is made only in the most sophisticated Defense Department contracting laboratories. And there's at least 10 tons of it unignited. Unignited. There must have been a whole lot more that was ignited, which then, by the way, this team of scientists put these chips in a differential scanning calorimeter, which is basically a heater, and they basically blow up. They produce a massive fizzle about 420 degrees centigrade, 800 or 900 degrees Fahrenheit. When they go off, they produce what? Thousands of spheres. The same spheres with the same chemical makeup that are found by the USGS throughout the World Trade Center dust. So there is no question about where those spheres came from, and that's the only rational explanation for them being there, by the way. Iron workers, we're told, may have created some of these spheres during the cleanup, but not 6% of all of the World Trade Center dust samples, not found up on the high-rise, not found on the Brooklyn Bridge and collected by a passerby 10 minutes after the collapse of these buildings. So what is this? What does the behavior of the towers themselves tell us? Well, these were very different than World Trade Center 7, which appears to be a classic implosion. The towers, we're told, were a gravitational collapse by the result of the impacts of the jet airplanes and the fires which resulted from the jet fuel. We're told weakened the structural steel, and we have a gravitational collapse because this 15-story section above the point of jet plane impacts, in the case of the North Tower, drove the rest of the building down to the ground. Well, there's so many problems with this. First of all, it drove it down at nearly free fall acceleration. So once again, it's way too fast for the 80,000 tons of structural steel beneath the point of jet plane impacts, provided little to no resistance. That doesn't even obey the laws of physics. This building, if it was going to collapse, would have fallen over toward the path of least resistance with large gradual deformations. But that's not what happens. It actually falls straight down through the path of greatest resistance at two-thirds of free-fall acceleration suddenly, symmetrically, smoothly, without any impact or jolt from the cold, hard, intact structure below. And this part up above is really looks like a mini-controlled demolition. At the beginning, the first 4 seconds, that top 15 stories is being destroyed, disintegrated. And then after that, what we see is an extremely explosive event where, for instance, 9-ton perimeter wall units are hurled laterally, landing 600 feet away, ejected at 70 to 100 miles per hour, instant speed out of the side of the towers. And then there's these incredible bands of explosions described by the first responders, by the way, 100 of them, described orally on tape in October of 2001. Bands of explosions, pop, 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 wrapping all the way around the building at the onset of destruction. None of these witnesses of explosions from outside the building or the firefighters and others from inside the building. There's hundreds of witnesses of explosions. Not one of them appear in the official narrative, the NIST report, the 9/11 Commission report. It's been completely expunged of these explosions. They even saw flashes of light. Dozens of see flashes of light, which are not characteristic of fires. These rhythmic engineered phenomena occurring all over the building. But as these bands of explosions are going off, they're producing this incredible pyroclastic-like clouds with incredible heat, where the gases unfold themselves in these cauliflower-like shapes reminiscent of huge explosives or volcanic eruptions with suspended solids in the air, in this case 90,000 tons of concrete being pulverized midair, along with the 10,000 floor trusses, along with tens of thousands of file cabinets, and all the solids from these buildings. You know, they don't find one file cabinet at the base of these buildings. The photos and videos don't show a stack of floors 20 floors high, which you'd expect in a gravitational collapse. The composite floor system, it has 22-gauge metal decking. 220 acres of it should have been found on this pile with broken-up concrete down at the base. I mean, it's a pancaking collapse. Where are the pancakes? They're gone. They have been destroyed systematically up above and spread throughout lower Manhattan. There's metal filings from the 10,000 floor trusses, the file cabinets. There's metal filings, a substantial portion of the dust. They come right up to the magnet along with those red-gray chips we talked about, along with those very curious microspheres of previously molten iron. Go ahead.
My guest is architect Richard Gage of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. We're talking about the collapse now of the World Trade Center towers. It would appear that the planes were a cover for the larger operation.
Well, yeah. If one is going to perform a deceptive controlled demolition with, by the way, not the normal explosives used for demolitions, but high energy explosives like C4 or RDX, a deceptive controlled demolition with thermite, which wouldn't provide the loud bangs and the bright flashes, You would and one to blame those on the airplanes and subsequent gravitational collapse due to structural weakening due to the fires due to the jet fuel from the airplanes. One would want to make sure that those planes there was a story to them, and so we don't really know who was on those planes. We have lots of reason not to trust the evidence provided to us about who was on those planes, given the evidence that the buildings were brought down by massive explosions. We would expect that they would have some way of ensuring that those planes hit their targets. and there's technology to facilitate that. Although, as architects and engineers, we don't go into that, but my speculation would be that those planes had a guidance system on them, which was common technology at the time, and would be brought through some sort of beacon system to ensure that it would hit its target at the floor that it was supposed to. And those explosions start not at that floor an hour after the plane hit or so, but up above. The explosions start, in the case of the North Tower, several floors above the point of jet plane impacts. So the explosives would not have, could have been arranged so that they weren't, you know, as severely disturbed by the plane impacts themselves.
It's interesting that the World Trade Center is 47 stories tall, which is taller than most of the any office building in San Francisco and most office buildings around the world. And it's like if it had been only Building 47 collapsing, people would have paid attention to it. But it's like traded off by those people who are focusing on the World Trade Center as if it was like a woodshed.
Yes. Building 7 was one of the highest buildings in most of our was the highest building in most of our states. But next to the Twin Towers, it seemed dwarfed by half of their height. So this is perhaps one of the reasons it's overlooked by the media. A more compelling reason to me is that it is so obviously an example of controlled demolition and not destruction by fire that it is itself the smoking gun, we call it, of 9/11. Once people get focused on this building, they know that it was some sort of an inside operation, because these all three of these buildings were, you know, very highly secure, probably among the most highly secure outside the Pentagon. After all, Building 7 had the IRS, the CIA, the FBI, the Defense Department, Securities and Exchange Commission, very highly secure operations. So we want a real investigation into the Securities and Exchange, the fire, which appears to be set primarily on the 12th floor, which is where the Securities and Exchange Commission office was, which lost thousands of files related to hundreds of cases that it was actively pursuing against Wall Street companies like Enron and WorldCom.
Now, you call into question, one of the things you're calling for is an investigation, a reopening the investigation 9/11, but also questioning the National Institute of Standards and Technology, I think it's called. Yes, how they, I was not actually aware that of the FEMA report that they had covered up or totally buried. But obviously, are they an organization that's ordinarily supposed to be competent and have a reputation?
Yes, they have a huge charter to control the standards throughout industry in our country. In addition, they've become a center for research into emerging technologies. They have had integrity. They are an agency under the Commerce Department, which is staffed and run and directed by the at the time, the Bush administration. So we are calling for a federal grand jury investigation of NIST's the NIST report, in this case, of the destruction of these towers, led by Shyam Sunder and co-project leader John Gross. We have an effort to secure an investigation about their conduct in this building report.
I'll be going to the phone in just a moment, but I want to ask a question. When you met with the representatives of Congress and you showed them the evidence, and some of it is available on your website, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, like the series showing the implosion of Building 7, what was the response?
The response from the individuals that we showed the evidence to was that they were all moved. This information is very clear, first of all. It's all backed up. It all is self-consistent. People who see these buildings coming down, and I presented this live with videos and so forth, people can all of a sudden see that these towers are blowing up. They're not a gravitational collapse. They can see Building 7 is an implosion. They're very moved. They tell me, I'll tell the senator, the congressman about this, and something has to happen here. Generally, though, they're more tight-lipped, but they're visibly moved. But then the follow-up is very difficult. We can't get any action. We can't get any response from the congressman. We've had one congressman write NIST and say, "Well, what did you look in the debris for thermite or nanothermite?" And the response is, in this case, a letter to NIST, and NIST responds and says, "Well, we didn't look for explosives or thermite, because they're common materials, and it would have been inconclusive anyway." Well, this is complete bunk and not true. I described to your listeners, who are intuitive enough to know that paint, for instance, doesn't blow up at 400 at 900 degrees Fahrenheit, and that these aluminum and iron oxide particles in these 10 tons of chips found in the dust are not ordinary materials at the nanoscale, intimately mixed and proportioned, just as thermite is. So people know when the wool is being pulled over their eyes after we give enough of this information like we have here, and particularly after they see this laid out very clearly on our DVD, which is called 9/11 Blueprint for Truth.
Well, I'm going to give people opportunity to tell up how to get that. Our board is lit up now. The number here, 895-2448. Let's go to the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Morning, Jeff. Jeff Wright on the Mendocino Coast. And to emphasize your point about this building demolition, I looked at the person when we watched that live coverage that day, and as the first building, the first tower was falling, we looked at each other and said, "That's a controlled demo," and I'm not an architect, so it was that blatant. And the aspect of the planes going through those buildings, could it be possible that the electrical lines that were getting ripped could have had high enough temperature to possibly set off maybe thermite impregnated into the insulation where ACE Elevator was working for months on those elevators and had full building access at night to possibly supplant that throughout the building and maybe even work the electrical panels to set off such controlled demolition? Of course, there's a lot to it, more to it than that, but time's short, so I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, the planes hit, and then an hour to an hour and a half later, the explosions start, after these fires were ignited. Is it possible the planes could have ignited thermite? Yes, but it also looks like the thermite, which is an incendiary, along with, we believe, in the towers, additional explosives, weren't set off until the onset of the destruction of the buildings, hour and a half later. You mentioned ACE Elevator. The question here is, how could somebody have set these charges without anybody knowing? You know, it takes months and dozens of people planting these explosives. Well, if they had access to the hoistways, elevator hoistways, they would have immediate access to all the core columns and beams in the buildings, and the occupants wouldn't know this. Now, even better, they had a cover operation, like an elevator modernization would have given them complete cover. And in fact, that's what we had. The 9 months prior to 9/11, there was the largest elevator modernization in the world going on in the Twin Towers. This would have given this company, which went out of business immediately after 9/11, by the way, ACE elevator access to do just that. And by the way, they scattered. They had 85 employees in the buildings, and they scattered after the first plane hit. They're supposed to stay around and help rescue the victims. I mean, after all, no high-rises collapsed due to fire, so why would they have scattered? It's a scandal documented in USA Today, which I think in October. There's some great questions there.
Well, here's some more questions coming up. Hello, you're on the air with Richard Gage.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for your courage in putting this program on. As a fellow member of the Engineers for 9/11 Truth, I wanted to tell Richard Gage, my experience has been that nobody wants to look at this. When I talk to people about it, it's like looking at the Afghan War. No one wants to see it. How do we move perception? I think the way you're doing it is correct, but I find that people are even reluctant to carry the newspaper, your newspaper, in their stores for fear they'll be seen as conspiracy nuts of some type. What do you think about that?
Good question, Ms. What should we be doing? What should the public be doing?
Well, the first step is to take seriously the assertion of over 1,000 architects and engineers. If that many architects and engineers told you that your house was in danger of collapsing, would you listen to them? Okay, so you make the decision to listen. You go to the website, ae911truth.org. You look at the information there. You can watch the DVD online. It can be purchased to watch also at home in our store. There's brochures then. Once you're convinced about the evidence, you can get these brochures and these cards and hand them to people, 100 of them, they're 6 cents, 9 cents a piece or something. And you say, and just because this is a grassroots movement, we're not getting very much coverage in the mainstream media, although Geraldo just came out last week saying that Building 7 looks like a controlled demolition. And by the way, these 1,200 architects, 1,300 architects and engineers must know something that I don't. That was impressive and helpful for us. And a week later, Judge Napolitano on Fox News says something very similar. So that's helpful. We're getting a little bit of movement now in the media, but largely it's a grassroots movement. So we have to take personal responsibility and take risks to tell our friends, our business associates, our family members. And some people get moved by this. They really get upset, because if 9/11 was some sort of an inside operation, which the controlled demolition is indicative of, right? I mean, we don't think Al-Qaeda had access to these buildings, the very secure buildings, to plant these explosives. So we're talking about someone else, with Al-Qaeda becoming a patsy in a scheme, a false flag operation, which, by the way, has been used to start every war we've been in. False flag meaning you attack yourself and you blame it on another country. You motivate Congress and people emotionally, manipulate them to go to war. And that's what we did, of course. We invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. 1 million people have already been killed over this. We've legislated our rights away. It was the Military Commissions Act, the Patriot Act. There's a lot of very horrible things, not to mention the policies like torture, that happened as a result of 9/11, that the security, the TSA intrusions that we have now at our airports. All of this is a result of this false flag operation. Now, the rug Richard, out from under it by the exposure of the demolition of these buildings.
That's a good way to end it. Our phones are, we're bringing, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the program. Richard Gage, architect the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, I want to thank you very, very much for being our guest today on Takes on the World and enlightening our listeners, who I'm sure would like to have you back again, as I think we will. So thanks again for listening and for being our guest on Takes on the World.
You're very welcome, Jeffrey. My pleasure.
Take care.